Welcome to Women and Sustainability, the podcast where we speak with some of the world's foremost female professionals from across the sustainability field, with me, your host, Emily Fripp. This month, I have the pleasure of speaking to Ema Fardi. Ema is the Head of Sustainability and Human Rights at the Hilton Food Group. Hilton Food Group is a London Stock Exchange-listed food packaging company, specialising in processing of protein products across meat, seafood, vegan and vegetarian categories. She is passionate about improving sustainability in livestock supply chains, including topics such as antibiotic reduction, animal welfare and environmental impacts. Part of Ema's role is delivering on Hilton Foods 2025 Sustainable Protein Plan, which focuses on producing products within the planetary boundaries and helping to restore and protect land and oceans for generations to come. Prior to this, Ema held a range of roles within the food and animal health industries, including working for Tesco. Her thoughtful approach to sustainability has led her to being shortlisted for the Women in Meat Industry Awards in the manufacturing and processing category. So I'm excited to share her cross-supply chain perspective with you all. We will all learn about sustainability in the meat and food processing industries, and I hope some of Ema's passion for change will inspire us all. Ema, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here with me today to talk about women and sustainability. We know you very well through our work with the Soy Working Sustainable Soy Group, the Manifesto. You're a core part of all of the stuff we do, and your valued contributions, I know, are really well received by the team. But there's more to you than just soy. You're currently the Head of Sustainability and Human Rights at the Hilton Food Group, which is a large company, London Stock Exchange, listed food packaging company. Lots going on there, and it's a big old role. I mean, you're involved in sort of human in the animal health, antibiotics, sustainability, UK, but I hear also you're on the plane flying around helping out everybody else sort out sort of antibiotics one minute in sort of Portugal, and then the next minute on a soy sustainability table telling us how to deal with the Brazilian supply chain. So how is my question to you? How did you get to being in this position where you're sort of a senior role within a large group? Not to belittle you in any way, I'm purely fascinated of where you came from and how you decided that this was a career you'd like to be in.
Thanks very much, Emily. That was a terrific introduction. One thing I do want to say is a massive thank you to your team. They've been phenomenal to me in terms of upskilling me and upskilling the industry and really giving us the skills and understanding in that soy space. So the how, I suppose. If I'm honest, I really love agriculture. I love animal production. And I always knew I wanted to work within that field. And then all of the things you've spoken about, like the reducing antibiotic use or the enabling our farmers to buy soy that doesn't contribute to deforestation, they're challenges for our, I see them as challenge for the industry that truthfully I love, to be resilient into the future. So they're all challenges, but it's about, to me, it's about understanding a farming supply base, understanding how you can implement those changes and how you can support farmers in doing it. In terms of Hilton Foods, how that all came about. So Hilton Foods is a big food processing company. We have operations across the UK, Europe and Australasia. And that really, that was a massive appeal for me to join the business. Because during my previous role at Tesco, I got, again, a lot of insight into foreign supply chains and about how we could bring those supply chains to the standards that we expected and like increase those standards. And Hilton basically was really appealing to me because it allows me to work across the globe. It allows me to learn from everybody. Like I learn from suppliers, I learn from our retail and food service partners, but also all the scientists, all of the industry working groups. I get real breadth of understanding.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating to hear you say that and speak like that, because so often there are so many siloed conversations, aren't there, where sort of the technical experts or the academics or the vets or farmers. I mean, even in some of the conversations we have at a sort of national and global level, there's quite often we talk about producers and farmers. We're talking about those in sort of overseas countries, whereas the heart of everything you do is with the farmers at home here and linking them into those international supply chains and those joined up conversations. I mean, I guess it's what we all love in this space, and bringing the different players together to create the change. How have you seen that evolve in the last sort of 5 to 10 years? You know, have you seen that sort of conversation take a different route or gain its traction?
Yeah, it's massively evolved in terms of, like, look, we're all very aware that a lot, like, we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions on farm. And that's a massive challenge. And I think it was always recognized as a challenge. And there was lots of work going on in different spaces. A bit of the challenge was that, like, for example, reducing greenhouse gas emissions on farm. What does a farmer need? A farmer needs to understand their greenhouse gas emissions, and then they need to have a decarbonisation plan. To me, that's just 3 or 4 areas of focus that when they implement will reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, that's a really complicated space. And what we have gotten a lot better at, I feel, over the last few years is having one voice and one version of the truth to farmers. Because when they're having a number of experts on their farm, like lots do, you need one farm plan. And I think that like the message can be, it's a very complicated space, and we need one version of how to get there. And so some countries are much further ahead on that than others, but everybody is getting there.
It's so true, isn't it? We sort of always take for granted the sort of lingos that we use, and we all understand it. But when you sort of think of going down to be at a shop front or a farmer or a producer, and you're talking about climate change, greenhouse gas emissions, and they're just going, I just want to produce my livestock to the best of my ability and have a future with my farm and for my generations to come. And it's a big jump of a conversation. It sounds like you've kind of loved the opportunity to get out there and have these conversations. What have been your big sort of obstacles or challenges, do you think? And maybe where are the big successes? What gives you that sort of smile when you think you've succeeded somewhere?
I really love seeing those, like, continuous improvement pieces. Like, obviously, when you make a gigantic leap, like when we eventually get soy to a place where we're able to purchase and know that all of our farms are able to purchase soy that doesn't contribute to deforestation, like, that's a big win. But I think we need to take, like, real pleasure out of the little ones as well, like those continuous improvements that you see within supply chains that you've worked with, like animal welfare improvements, the responsible use of antibiotic work over the last kind of decade, I think is a phenomenal achievement. And again, people are still working on it. They're still trying to reduce use, but there's been massive wins in it. And that's really impressive. Like, it's all been about having one combined ask from industry and then disseminating that into farms, but giving them the tools to do it properly and not compromising on welfare or health of animals. Because that's one thing we need to remember is farmers are there to rear healthy animals, and that's really important to them.
Yeah, I mean, they don't do it, you know. I think we, as a consumer, you have this perception of mass production all the time, and it's quite negative. But that's not reflective of all industry in the farming sector, is it?
I don't think it is at all. Being honest, like, there's that term factory farming really annoys me. I genuinely don't believe in the UK or Europe we do factory farm. And I think we have some really good production within our supply chains and within our countries.
And that's a message that we need to continue to work with in quite challenging times ahead. But before, when we think about sort of the farming industry, having sort of inspirational women leaders in that sector doesn't necessarily jump up at me, although obviously there is the head of the NFU and others. So there is brilliant, and there's some great inspirational people there. Have you seen the role of women change as this sort of topic has changed within the sector that you're working in?
Look, being honest, I think that women are active in all areas of the supply chain right now, from farm to fork. You recognise Minette there, and Minette has been a fantastic leader for farmers within the UK. To be fair, the NFU's ambition to be, I think it's net zero by 2040. Like that, they were one of the first to come out with that, if not the first farming organization to come out with that. And they were very transparent in there. We don't know how we're going to do it at the start, but this is our aim. And now they're building the how. I think the industry is more male dominated when you look around it. And it's really important that we're seen as an attractive industry for women, because we need access to top talent. And that is really important. Like, being honest, I work with women every day. And my reporting lines, I can very much see, is probably not the norm. I've been quite privileged. But you definitely see a lot more now than you used to. And there's been quite a few mechanisms put in place when you think about it to deliver that. Like at Hilton, we saw that we needed access to best talent. And as part of that, we had a target for 30% of our senior leadership roles to be held by women. And that was by 2025. And we've actually surpassed that target. And we developed a women's network and we sponsor Meet Business Women. Again, like we were talking about farming, and when I was growing up, it would have been unusual to see women farmers. Now, there are some women farmers, still obviously far more men. But I actually heard from an incredibly inspiring young female farmer at the European Roundtable on Beef Sustainability event in Ireland, basically a couple of weeks ago. Her name was Aisling, and it was really good to see her story. You know, she was really, really positive, really science-driven, really data-driven. And the improvements she'd made on her farm since she'd taken it over were massive. And again, farming has a big challenge, never mind just women, but also in terms of the very aging demographic. And it's really important that we have people to take up those roles and who want to see farming as a viable lifestyle and a viable financial, because it is a job as well. It needs to be profitable.
And there are different aspects. I mean, it feels like a very exciting time to be in it, although it's incredibly challenging time to be in the farming sector. And we probably all see and hear those news stories. But there's also the sort of excitement as to, you know, as you say, factory farming, that not particularly nice term that's used. But there are many different alternatives now, and probably traditional methods coming back to the fore. Do you think that the attraction to not just women, but younger farmers coming into the space, it's almost because the narrative around what is farming and how it is has broadened? I mean, it feels like it's broadened in what it curtails. It's the technical side, the data, but the opportunities within it. It doesn't have to just, doesn't feel like it's, I'm going to be, you know, a farmer in a sort of limited space. It feels like you've got a lot more going on as a farmer to get your teeth into and different ways of working. Is that true? Or, I mean,
I think
I'm not an expert.
No, I think it's different, more going on. Like, you would be doing a lot less manually, but you'd have a lot more data, and it's becoming nearly like way more scientific, and there's a lot more going on in terms of management. But I think it's different. I think it's becoming a more different role than it was, like when my grandfather farmed, for example.
Yeah. So coming back to the women, and it's great to hear the initiatives going on in Hilton Foods and that sort of best talent, the 30% of senior leadership by 2025. I mean, that's a significant step in the right direction and something that's going on. So have you had any sort of female role models in your career that were kind of, you know, when you're setting out and your degrees and then you're going into Tesco, coming into Hilton and then going, you know what, I can do this. I'm going for the top. Or were there people that inspired you along the way, or was it just sort of an inherent drive? I'm going to get this.
No, there was definitely quite a few, being honest. And there was quite a lot. I was really fortunate to have quite a lot of female role models through both Tesco and Hilton. And like, I know you both know me quite well, but for me, the most exciting bit about my role is implementation. That's the bit I like. It's the bit about implementing the science into a supply chain. And that for me is really important. And I think it's really important that businesses have leaders that enable that. And especially within sustainability, we need our leaders to like support and enable embedding into core functions, with the understanding that it's still evolving, because that's one thing within our space is today's perfect isn't tomorrow's perfect. It's going to constantly evolve, and that's really important. For me, Lorna is my Chief Quality and Sustainability Officer, and she's a phenomenal role model. But a great strength of hers is how she supports those that work for her to do their job. Like, she makes it easy for me to do my job. She makes my work better without annoying me, which, to be fair, is a skill. But she's given me more opportunity than I've had both within our organization and outside of it. But that, in like, as an industry, we really need leaders like that, leaders who enable people to come up. Another one for me would be Dr. Fiona Roberts. She is really passionate about continuous improvement on farm, and she taught me an awful lot in that space, especially in my early days. But it's all about passion. Like, she's really passionate about what she does. She brings a science-based approach. She shows people how to make their data work harder. But most importantly with her, she came from education and she's a teacher. Like, when you leave her, you understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, and what makes it better, if that makes sense. Because I think understanding that helps a lot as opposed to being told what to do.
Yeah, it's a great skill that she has. That's fantastic. So, what sort of challenges and opportunities do you think lie ahead then in the sort of space in your sector, but equally within sort of getting more women into the space and more women coming up through the system and within organisations as well as the actual sort of farming sector?
I think a lot of it is down to us. Like, for example, I spoke at I don't know if it was a conference, but basically I was invited to a university and I spoke to a bunch of young researchers and they were all after doing PhDs or postdocs. And for me, in food now, we need science. We need scientists. We need people who are able to tell us what we need to implement. And it's really important that we have those type of people choose food, and those skill sets choose food. And I'm really passionate about food industry. I love eating it. I love making it. I love producing it. And we need those people, you know, to want to do it. And a lot of that is down to us. It's about sharing what we do. Like, if I'm honest, when I did my degree, I didn't know my job existed. I had no clue. When I did my master's, I didn't know this job existed. And even in my time within a role like this, it's drastically changed. Like, the sustainability function used to be a kind of a separate function within businesses, and now it's like directly within company categories, which I think it's really nice to see.
It's definitely a real step change. And like you say, it's that recognition that sustainability is about longevity of future business. It's you're not a tree hugger. It's which is, you know, a label that we all get. And there's some great tree huggers out there, but that's not necessarily something we want to sort of inspire. And it's got to be at the heart of every single business decision that is made moving forward and policy space, so that it's just integral in the ways things work. It shouldn't be the add-on. So there is the big debate, and I can't not ask the question of the sort of general public and the opinion that, you know, do we need to all give up meat? Do we need to become vegans? I know where I stand on that question, but I've got to ask it.
Where do you stand on it, Emily, out of curiosity?
Where do I stand on it?
Yeah,
I think a little bit of everything is what's needed. I don't think we should be all one thing or all the other, personally. And my big gripe is I think that we all eat too much and throw too much away. And if we actually all ate less, threw less away, it wouldn't matter whether you were a vegan or a meat eater, because actually it's just our general overconsumption and greediness as a population that I think does more harm than what you'd like to eat on a personal day-to-day basis. That's my personal view.
I agree with you massively, especially around the food waste piece. I actually, it's a weird personal, well, not a weird personal gripe, but it's the personal gripe of people throwing away meat. I really think is really inappropriate when you raise an animal for that. It is something that and we're doing a lot as a business in terms of food waste. We're doing a lot as an industry in terms of food waste. But the fact remains that the majority of food waste does happen in homes. And there is stuff we can do. We're constantly working on like packaging solutions to like have longer shelf life. But there is a piece around people really understanding that freezers work. And if you're not going to use your meat, put it in the freezer.
Well, and I think food is too cheap, can I say that, in a sort of, without getting political, but that, you know, that, or it's the value of food is just not generally appreciated. And you do look back and think, if you really value your Sunday roast, as generations ago they really did, that roast would see you through an entire week's meat meals in different forms and different bits. I remember my mum mincing up things with her own hand mincer and doing all sorts of stuff, and my dad having his beef sandwiches for most of the week. And if that, to me, if that's what meat eaters really want and value and appreciate, then I think that's absolutely fine, because I think we'd all consume less.
I think your point on cheap food is one that's made quite a lot within the industry. And I think what you've just said there about value, I think they're kind of different. Like, the fact is we're in very privileged positions where, let's be honest, we're not worried when we're at a grocery shop till, which is a very privileged space to be. I think increasing the cost of food would be detrimental, if I'm honest, from a society perspective. However, valuing it is different. And we can do that through education. But we need to value food for what it is, so we don't throw it out. And then it comes down to like paying for food and that piece around public good for public money, because like my personal belief is that meat, for example, can't pay for all of nature, because the product, like the farmer's producing two things, they're producing animals, and then they're doing land. We're asking way more from them in terms of forests and hedge growths and all of that. And that could take place with the carbon market. It could take place with, like, we see some great examples in Europe of common agricultural policy and how that is coming across. But especially when you look wider to like third world countries, because unfortunately we can't, fixing everything in the UK and Europe doesn't solve a global problem.
No, and it is about It is about valuing, and I think, you know, lowering the price of food, cheap food, that is a problem. But I think it's part of a systemic problem. And if you can only raise the price of food if you find other ways to subsidize people who need to purchase it. You're absolutely right. In that sort of poverty space, you can't just put the price up. But it's a complicated space. And I think sometimes we sort of see just one side of the question, the price on a supermarket shelf, and we're not considering the whole holistic package, and we're not thinking about the other ways to support the farmer, but also the consumer in the right way. And, you know, if it can boil down to just understanding the true value in what we're eating, I think that's a fundamental core place to start.
Yeah. Will I just pick up on the role of meat in a diet, because I realise it looked to everybody like I dodged it. For me, there really is a role for meat in the diet. There's a real role for animal proteins. Alice Staunton has led some incredible work in that space. That doesn't step away from the fact that we do need to eat differently. Like, we have an obesity crisis. You just touched on poverty. Like, there's big challenges. But I really think that there is a role for meat. There's a role for high quality protein. There's a role for dairy. We need it for calcium. There's a lot of science behind that. And we really need to be careful as we transition and nudge people towards what we're calling sustainable diets, that we don't have unintended consequences in terms of human health. And to be fair, in terms of planetary boundaries, because we do need to produce food within planetary boundaries, and to be fair, that does include, in my opinion, livestock.
So finally, my final question to you would be, do you have any final words of wisdom, advice to other women out there who might want to get involved in this sector and in the space that you've been lucky enough to be working in?
Honestly, my answer would be do it. I feel really privileged that I actually enjoy getting up and going to work every day. Everybody doesn't get that. Some people work in jobs that are 9 to 5, and if that suits you, that suits you. But it's a really exciting field to be a part of. If you're really interested in it, I think you have to continuously learn. Like, I did my degree, I did my master's part-time, and I'm doing another one at the moment. And it's really important to upskill and to make sure that you're learning. Have an inquisitive mind when you see the challenges that come up against you. Look, be solution-based. Try to understand how you can bring an industry with you to meet a challenge, and understand that there are also great people within our industry to learn from. And do reach out if you want to have a chat. But it is a phenomenal industry to be a part of.
And thank you incredibly for your time. Thank you so very much. Fascinating. Love talking to you. And we will continue to be talking to you in days and weeks to come on the topics we've just been talking about. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Emily.
A huge thank you, Ema, for joining me today, and thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe, and we hope you can join us soon for another episode.